In 45 years of 60 Minutes, we have never interviewed a serial killer until now.
Do you consider yourself a serial killer?
I guess it depends upon a person's definition. If it's more than one and it's a pattern, I guess, then yes.
Not only is he a serial killer, he is one of the most prolific serial killers in U.S. history. Charles Cullen admits to as many as 40 murders, though some suspect it's a lot more. They took place over 16 years in 7 different hospitals, where Cullen, a critical care nurse, gave unsuspecting patients lethal doses of powerful drugs.
We'll never know how many people Charlie Cullen killed.
How many do you think?
I would be very surprised, as would pretty much everyone I've spoken to with any knowledge of this case, if it was not in the hundreds, multiple hundreds.
Madagascar is a paradise of plants and animals found nowhere else in the world, like wide-eyed lemurs, chameleons that sparkle with color, geckos that hide in plain sight, and more than 200 kinds of frogs. But we were searching for a rare creature that has roamed the earth for more than 200 million years.
They found one.
I'm Steve Croft.
I'm Leslie Stahl.
I'm Morley Safer.
I'm Bob Simon.
I'm Laura Logan.
I'm Scott Pelley. Those stories tonight on 60 Minutes.
Tonight, you're going to come face to face with a serial killer, one of the most prolific in U.S. history. Serial killers don't usually talk to reporters. In fact, this story, which first ran in April, was the first time in the 45 years of 60 Minutes that we ever interviewed one. Charles Cullen was a critical care nurse who admits to killing up to 40 people. Some suspect it was a lot more. The murders took place over 16 years in 7 different hospitals. There were suspicions at nearly all of them that Cullen was harming patients, yet none of them passed that information on to subsequent employers. Newspaper headlines called him the Angel of Death, but as you will see, Charles Cullen was no mercy killer. Until we interviewed him 4 months ago, he'd never spoken publicly about his crimes, never tried to explain why he did it, or even express remorse to the families of victims when he finally faced them in court.
This monster didn't even know us or our son, but had the audacity to end his life.
I'd like to tell you a little bit about my mother that you murdered. You don't even have the guts to look this way, do you?
Charles, why don't you look up at us? I'd like to show you what you did to our children. This is their dad in his coffin. How do you like that? Would you
like your This was the scene 7 years ago at the Somerset County Courthouse in New Jersey, as Charles Cullen sat through his sentencing hearing, refusing to speak or even acknowledge the family members of people he had murdered. Even the judge was exasperated.
Mr. Cullen, I ask you a question. Why is it that you have chosen not to address the court? Can you hear me, Mr. Cullen?
He's kept that silence behind the walls of the New Jersey State Prison in Trenton, where he is in protective custody to keep him safe from other inmates. Protecting himself from his own demons has been more difficult. We found out when we sat down across from him in a cramped cubicle separated by a thick layer of glass to talk about the people he's killed.
Is 40 an arbitrary number?
40 is an estimate. I gave a number between 30 and 40. I think I have identified, most of them.
Look, you pled guilty to murder. But you don't use that word.
I think that I had a lot of trouble accepting that word for a long time. I accept that that's what it is.
Do you consider yourself a serial killer?
I guess it depends upon a person's definition. If it's more than one and it's a pattern, I guess, then yes.
In Cullen's case, all of his victims were patients assigned to hospital units where he worked as a nurse. They ranged in age from 21 to 91. Some were critically ill. Others were ready to be discharged when Cullen injected them with drugs that would kill them. It was a pattern that began 26 years ago at St. Barnabas Medical Center in Livingston, New Jersey, Cullen's very first nursing job.
I worked on the burn unit, so, there was a lot of pain, a lot of suffering. And I didn't cope with that as well as I thought I would.
And that was the first place that you gave someone medication that caused them to die?
The patient was John Yengo, a judge from New Jersey who was suffering from a severe case of sunburn until Cullen injected him with a fatal overdose of lidocaine.
Do you remember the person?
I remember one, and that's the only person I've been able to identify.
But there could have been more. St. Barnabas didn't know about the patient Cullen murdered, but it did suspect him of trying to kill or harm a half a dozen other patients by randomly and repeatedly poisoning bags of saline solution.
Someone was spiking IV bags with insulin in the storeroom.
Charles Graber, a New York writer, as well as a former medical student and researcher, has spent 7 years investigating Cullen's murders for a new book called The Good Nurse. Graber says a number of patients at St. Barnabas went into insulin shock and nearly died.
He was the main suspect for poisoning random bags of saline. If you talk to the investigators there, they'll tell you, Cullen was our man, we knew he was dirty. They couldn't prove anything. It's all circumstantial.
They fire him?
He moved on.
When Cullen left the hospital, the insulin overdoses stopped.
At St. Barnabas, they could have had my license investigated and probably revoked at that point in time.
Should they have?
Should they have, yes.
But instead of ending Charles Cullen's nursing career, St. Barnabas marked the beginning of a 16-year killing spree. Cullen would work at 8 other hospitals and be suspected of harming patients at 6 of them. But those suspicions never reached subsequent employers, and Cullen continued to murder patients with virtually impunity. In 1993, prosecutors investigated Cullen for murdering 91-year-old Helen Dean. An autopsy tested for nearly 100 medications, but not the one Cullen used to kill her, a powerful drug called Digoxin, or Didge for short. It was Cullen's first weapon of choice.
Why did you like Didge?
Didge, was a very powerful cardiac medication.
What does it do to someone?
In small amounts, it slows the heart rate down. In larger amounts, it can cause what's called complete heart block. And then the heart is very irregular. And, it can cause death. It does cause death in large amounts.
It was also readily available in critical care units, and Cullen figured out ways to conceal his digoxin withdrawals from an automatic drug dispensary system called Pyxis, which required nurses to type in the name of the patient and the drug to be administered.
I wouldn't go in under Didge. I would go under Tylenol or another medication that would be in the same drawer. So, there was no record of me going in for Didge other than the fact that, it was in the same drawer.
How did you choose who you were going to give this medication to?
It's difficult for me to go back in time and think about what things were running through my mind at the time.
Was it personal?
No.
Did you get pleasure out of it? Satisfaction?
No, I thought that people weren't suffering anymore, so in a sense, I thought I was helping.
Cullen suggested several times that his actions were merciful, but the evidence doesn't support it. 60-year-old Eleanor Stecker, an asthma patient, was recovering and in no pain when Cullen administered a fatal digoxin overdose. College student Michael Strenko, who suffered from an autoimmune disease, was recovering from what his parents called routine surgery to remove his spleen.
My heart, it aches for my son. It bleeds for my son.
We vividly remember Charles Cullen walking into the waiting room. He looked us right in the eye and stated how Michael was gravely ill and people don't make it. And my wife told Cullen, "That's enough. You could leave now." We're haunted by the memory of Charles Cullen coming to the waiting room to get our reaction.
There were people that you caused to die who were not near death and not suffering that much.
My goal here isn't to justify, what I did. There is no justification. I just think that The only thing I can say is that I felt overwhelmed at the time.
Can you give us anything? Can you give the families anything? Any explanation for how this happened and why this happened?
Like I said, I can't. I just can say that it was more or less, felt like I needed to do something. And I did. And that's not an answer to anything.
Charles Cullen was the youngest of eight children and grew up poor on this street in West Orange, New Jersey, protected by his mother. Cullen was 17 when she died. He tried to kill himself. He spent 6 years in the Navy, most of them as a missile technician on a nuclear submarine. He was miserable, felt bullied, tried to kill himself again. After receiving a general discharge, he decided to take up nursing. He got married and started a family, but it all went sour. A messy divorce, custody battles, bankruptcy, heavy drinking, more half-hearted suicide attempts, and trips to the psychiatric ward. That was Charles Cullen's state of mind when he was killing people and on the night he finally confessed to the murders.
I tried to kill myself throughout my life because I never really liked being who I was, because I didn't think I was worthy of anything.
It was never about anyone but Charlie Cullen. He did what he did because of his own needs, his own compulsions.
Author Charles Graber interviewed Cullen more than a dozen times for his book, and he remembers seeing words like paranoid, major depression, hostile, passive-aggressive, and antisocial on psychiatric reports.
He sees himself as a victim, and as a victim, he's entitled to lash out in any way he wants. To make things right, if that means killing patients. It just, anything justifies his victimhood.
You said at one point that you thought it was about power and control. What do you mean?
If the rest of his life was spinning out of control, if he was losing custody, if he was feeling depressed, if his love life was in the toilet, he could poison patients, he could save patients. He could make decisions. He had an arena in which he mattered and where his actions had definite consequence.
Here you have a person who tried to kill himself at least 20 times, who was in and out of psych wards, and on some occasions walked right out of the psych ward and right into a job as a critical care nurse.
Right. He actually took a call asking him back on shift from a psych ward.
Why wouldn't the hospitals do some background checks?
Well, partially because they weren't required to, and partially because there was a nursing shortage on. Charlie Cullen looked good. By the end of his career, he was a 16-year veteran. He had recommendations. And for a hospital to ask too much or say too much became a liability. You can't penalize a nurse for seeking counseling, for seeking treatment, for going to a rehab center successfully. And so, because of that, Charlie hid in those shadows.
When Cullen was hired at St. Luke's University Hospital in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, he'd been fired or forced to resign from five other hospitals. Yet none of this was in his file with the state nursing board. By his own count, Cullen had already murdered 11 people, and he would kill at least five more at St. Luke's. Nurses were suspicious. There were rumors about his past. And Cullen was caught red-handed stealing lethal drugs. But instead of calling the police, St. Luke's brought in a lawyer to confront Cullen.
Do you think that they knew what you were doing at St. Luke's?
I think that they had a strong suspicion.
Did you expect to get caught?
I think you can say I was caught at St. Barnabas and I was caught at St. Luke's. There's no reason that I should have been a practicing nurse after that.
They offered you some kind of a deal?
They said, if you resign, we'll give you neutral references. And I decided to go with that.
What is it about this system and about hospitals that no one went to the police? No one really wanted to find out what was going on. they gave you an opportunity to leave?
I think because it's a matter of worrying about lawsuits. If they pointed out that there was a problem, we're going to be found liable for millions of dollars. So they, I guess they just saw it as a lot easier to not put themselves in a position of getting sued.
After Charles Cullen was escorted out the door of St. Luke's Hospital with no consequences, one of the nurses called a friend at the Pennsylvania State Police with her suspicions, and an investigation was begun. By then, Cullen had already found another job at the Somerset Medical Center in New Jersey. He would murder another 13 people there, but it would be his final stop. That story when we come back. In September 2002, when Charles Cullen was hired as a critical care nurse at New Jersey's Somerset Medical Center, the hospital knew nothing about his dark past. It didn't know that he'd been fired or forced to resign at a half a dozen hospitals, or that he'd been investigated by authorities for harming patients. And there was no reason to suspect that Cullen had murdered five patients at his last job. As we first reported in April, he was able to move from hospital to hospital without so much as a bad reference. Cullen would kill another 13 people at Somerset in 13 months and try and kill three more before two detectives, a state official, and a female nurse finally connected the dots.
You were under suspicion at St. Luke's. Yet you went off to Somerset and kept doing exactly the same things. And it looks like, to me, that you wanted to get caught.
I don't know.
You don't know?
Because, you know, you're right. I mean, I continued. But I was also careful. I was also denied any time anybody would have asked me.
It was the suspicious death of a Roman Catholic priest named Florian Gall that set in motion the events that would eventually expose Charles Cullen. Reverend Gall had died unexpectedly overnight while recovering from pneumonia, and the hospital discovered high levels of the heart drug digoxin in his blood. It was the second unexplained overdose in 2 weeks.
The blood levels were astronomical. They're way higher than you would ever shoot for by using the drug therapeutically.
Dr. Stephen Marcus is the director of New Jersey's Poison Control Center. He heard about the digoxin overdoses when a pharmacist at Somerset called his office asking for help with some dosage calculations. The pharmacist also confided that two more patients in the same unit had turned up with abnormally high levels of insulin.
What's going through your mind?
My number one, two, and three thought was that there was something malicious going on in the institution.
In July of 2003, Marcus set up an urgent conference call with the hospital's medical director, Dr. William Coors, and taped the conversation, in which he told the hospital to notify the authorities.
This is a police matter.
What we're wrestling with is, throwing the whole institution into chaos versus responsibility to, protect patients from further harm. And we have been trying to investigate this to get some more information before we made any kind of rush to, judgment.
If there is somebody out there that is purposely doing this to individuals at your hospital, we have a legal obligation to report this.
Okay.
Somerset Medical Center would eventually notify authorities, but it would take them 3 long months.
Do you know how many patients died between those?
No, I don't know the number, but I do know that there were some patients that died in between them.
Yes. Five.
That we know of.
But those
five deaths, I'll remember them the rest of my life. Sorry.
They didn't have to happen.
They should have been preventable, yes.
It was October before Somerset County Detectives Tim Braun and Daniel Baldwin finally met with hospital officials. They were told about a half a dozen incidents in the critical care unit. No one used the word homicide.
They had dropped a couple names on us with regards to their own internal investigation that they claimed to have conducted for several months. And they did provide us two names in particular, but did not identify them as any type of suspect or anything like that.
One of them was Charles Cullen.
Correct.
The detectives ran a routine background check on Charles Cullen and discovered that he'd been arrested for stalking a female nurse and breaking into her apartment in Easton, Pennsylvania. The file there also contained a post-it note saying that the Pennsylvania State Police had called just a few weeks earlier asking similar questions. Detective Baldwin called the trooper who made the inquiry and hit pay dirt.
After speaking with the trooper, he informed me that his agency had conducted an investigation on Mr. Cullen with a suspicion that he was murdering patients in Pennsylvania as well, that he was using digoxin to murder patients.
And you found this out with making two phone calls?
Yes, yeah, basically.
That was it.
Do you think you had your man?
Yes.
Yes.
But the detectives knew that proving it would be difficult. A number of law enforcement agencies had tried and failed.
How helpful was the hospital in this investigation?
How helpful was the hospital? They were very helpful by answering court-issued subpoenas. That was the extent of their cooperation.
When the detectives asked to see computerized records from the automated drug dispensary in the critical care unit, they say the hospital told them that it wasn't possible because the drug dispensing machine only stored records for 30 days. They learned otherwise from the machine's manufacturer.
They lied to you.
Yes, they did.
They didn't want to give you records that turned out to be crucial to your investigation.
Yes, that's correct.
You think they tried to obstruct your investigation?
They didn't try to help it, that's for sure.
When the detectives informed Somerset that Charles Cullen was the target of their investigation, the hospital fired him, not for harming patients, for lying on his job application.
Did you get the sense at Somerset, for example, that any of your colleagues, any of the nurses, any of the doctors knew what was going on?
No. I mean, until, you know, the day I was fired, I mean, nobody gave me any indication that anybody was suspicious. I mean, the weird thing about Somerset Hospital is that they were planning on firing me the night before. So they let me work one more shift, knowing that they were going to fire me the next day. So they let me work an additional shift with the suspicion that I had harmed patients, which I, you know, is kind of a bizarre thing to do.
Did you harm anybody that night?
No.
With Cullen gone and the medical center uncooperative, Detectives Braun and Baldwin decided they needed an ally inside the hospital to help them gather evidence to make their case. They decided to approach Amy Ridgway, a critical care nurse who worked with Cullen on the night shift and was his best friend at the hospital.
He was always early, always on time, crisp, and sat down and was very serious about getting to work.
Did you consider him to be a good nurse?
I did.
When the detectives first interviewed Ridgway, she was hostile and upset that Cullen had been fired. So they decided to show her the evidence that they had gathered. The Pyxis record showing Cullen's drug withdrawals from the dispensary and his real employment history.
What'd you tell her? Do you remember?
I just told her that he was released from several facilities. There were allegations about him at other facilities for doing similar things that were going on at Somerset Medical Center. And I guess at that point she realized this couldn't be a coincidence.
And she offered to help?
Yes.
Danny pushed this piece of paper across the table to me. And it was the Pyxis printouts. And I was devastated. I knew he was murdering people.
How did you know that?
There were so many withdrawals of lethal medications. There's no reason. No reason except if you want to kill someone.
Were you angry?
I was sad for my patients. I was, so many things were going through my mind. I was sad I didn't see it. I felt betrayed by my own intuition.
Amy Ridgway, who later persuaded Cullen to do the interview with us, spent days analyzing medical records for the detectives and schooled them on a computerized record system that would help reconstruct Cullen's activities on specific days. She recorded phone conversations with Cullen and wore a wire at a meeting in this restaurant, The same day, a newspaper article reported that he was being investigated for killing patients.
I said, I know you're guilty. I know. I know you did this. And yet, I'm still here. I'll take you down to the station. We'll go together. And he changed. His face just changed.
And what did he say?
He said, I want to go down fighting. I want to go down fighting.
Cullen told us he suspected that the police were listening in.
I knew that Amy had helped the police. I strongly suspected that she was wired when she was asking me those questions. So, that didn't stop me having the same opinion of Amy, which is that she's a good nurse, that she's a caring nurse, and that she did it because she felt it was the right thing to do.
He was arrested right after that meeting on what police now admit was mostly circumstantial evidence. What they needed was a confession, but Cullen refused to say anything. So once again, the police turned to Amy Ridgway for help.
What did you say to get him to confess?
I wasn't very honest with him. And there's a part of me, I still feel guilty about that. I was manipulating him a bit. I told him the investigators were also looking at me. And how could he think that I wasn't somehow going to be implicated? I remember saying to him, so who was your first victim? And was it a long time ago? Was it recent? And he started to talk. He said it was a long time ago.
I believe it was with a medication to drop the blood pressure.
Cullen's formal confession with the detectives would last 7 hours.
Cardiac event.
We'll never know how many people Charlie Cullen killed.
Charles Graber spent 7 years investigating the case for his book, The Good Nurse.
It's very difficult going back. There's no paperwork. There are no bodies to exhume. He's working over 16 years. In St. Barnabas alone, he later told investigators he was dosing 3 to 4 people a week. He didn't always know their outcomes.
How many do you think?
I would be very surprised, as would pretty much everyone I've spoken to with any knowledge of this case, if it was not in the hundreds, multiple hundreds.
You've been in here a while.
9 years.
You knew it was wrong?
Yes, I did.
At the time?
At the time and later.
Are you sorry what you did?
Yes. But like I said, I don't know if I would have stopped.
Not since the dinosaurs disappeared have animals been going extinct as fast as they are now. Entire species vanish every year. And while our hearts are moved by the plight of the biggest, whales or elephants, the fiercest, tigers, even sharks, and certainly the cutest, like pandas, what about the slowest? The turtle and its land-loving cousin, the tortoise, have been plodding along, slow and steady, for more than 200 million years. But their hard shells are little protection from human predators and a booming illegal animal trade. It may be too late to save many of them, but as we reported last December, they have found an unlikely protector in a man named Eric Good. Some of New York City's hottest hotels, restaurants, and bars are owned by Eric Good.
Hello.
Hi. I need to say hello to people that I haven't said hello to. Hi.
That's made him rich and comfortable with the glitterati and fashionistas. But behind the scenes, he caters to a far less glamorous clientele, endangered turtles and tortoises. How did the whole interest, if not obsession, with turtles and tortoises begin?
As a child at six, I was given a small Herman's tortoise. And that created a budding interest in the natural world and in reptiles and snakes and lizards and in my hard-shelled friends that I just fell in love with. And so it was a progression.
It's an obsession that takes him as far from the glitz of the New York scene as imaginable. He wades through swamps, turns over rocks, wrangles exotic snakes and other reptiles as he searches for his first love.
What a beautiful tortoise. This is our first Samobates tentaurus trimeni.
Turtles and tortoises trace back before the dinosaurs. But now today, about half of the over 300 species are headed toward extinction, largely because of habitat loss and an insatiable market for them, particularly in Asia, as food, medicine, rare collector's items, and pets.
How big a business is the turtle-tortoise trade?
China alone is probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars. This trade flourishes because the payoff is huge and the chance of getting prosecuted and incarcerated are very low.
If you're going to be in something illicit, this is the safest or one of the safest.
And that's a tragedy.
Eric Good is spending $1 million a year of his own money to fight the trade in places like Madagascar, an island off the coast of Africa that's vastly undeveloped.
People are so poor. And some of these villages make less than a dollar a day, or it's basically subsistence living. And there just simply isn't the political will of the country to really enforce, you know, what's going on with their natural heritage, whether it's tortoises or other wildlife.
Fly over Madagascar, and you can see why conservationists say it's bleeding to death. Rivers run red with soil erosion from logging and slash-and-burn agriculture that have wiped out animal habitats and 90% of the country's forests. And yet, because of its isolation, Madagascar is a paradise of plants and animals found nowhere else, like the wide-eyed lemurs, chameleons that sparkle with color, geckos that hide in plain sight, more than 200 kinds of frogs, and 5 species of rare turtles and tortoises. Eric was taking us on a trek to find the fastest disappearing animal in Madagascar, the plowshare tortoise, whose shrinking habitat is so deep in the wilderness, it's only accessible by boat.
This tortoise is one of the world's most endangered animals. It is the world's most endangered tortoise, and it has an incredibly high price on its head. Asian countries love gold, and this is a gold tortoise. And so literally, these are like gold bricks that one can pick up and sell.
We were following the path the poachers take, landing on a deserted beach. And off we went on a long hike. We walked through scrub brush in blazing heat for almost an hour.
The sun starts to go up too high, they just disappear.
The once plentiful plowshare population here, he says, could be down to as few as 300 adults.
And this is where the guards are based.
Good has helped hire around 40 locals to go out and find the tortoises before the poachers do.
We have to be on a team of many people.
Different lines, 30 feet apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go.
We lined up the way police do when they search for a missing person. And by midday, with a lot of help, we got lucky.
They found one.
Oh, look at that. How
wow.
did you ever find it?
Wow. Oh, it's a beautiful female. So this is just a perfect, perfect female. Now this tortoise is a crown jewel. Oh. This is a beautiful animal.
Look at her.
Yeah, and you see this is this incredible domed shell that's unique with this tortoise. No turtle has this shell like an army helmet. This is a very, very valuable tortoise.
Based on his own research, Good says a tortoise like this could sell for $60,000 in Asia. To try and stop the trafficking, he and his colleagues have begun doing the unthinkable.
It's a drill. Oh, my God.
Yeah. He has to be very careful not to hit the bone because then we'll draw blood. So he's going just that very carefully, 16th of an inch into the shell.
They want to leave an indelible gash, a scar, that makes the tortoises undesirable to collectors.
I have to tell you, watching Angelo do this, it's painful. It is painful to watch.
Yeah, no, it's very hard. But I think we're at a point where we're down to so few animals, there's so few of these tortoises left that we have to really take extreme measures.
scarring the shells of these animals, defacing them, etching. Is that working? Can you tell yet?
It's too soon to know if that's working. It breaks your heart to have to do that to this beautiful, beautiful shell. I mean, you can compare it maybe to chainsawing off a rhinoceros's horn to save a rhino. I mean, how horrible is that?
To show us what he's up against, Eric took us to a market in a small city called Mahajunga, where we saw, with our hidden camera, shells of endangered tortoises out in the open, on display for sale. And soon we were being offered live tortoises. So
what is this? This is a
spider tortoise from southern Madagascar. This is critically endangered. And the Chinese sometimes just puncture the shell just to eat the liver out of this tortoise.
One of the vendors showed up with something in a plastic bag.
What is it?
Wow!
It was a radiated tortoise on the endangered species list. Asking price, just $400. We were even offered a plowshare tortoise if we paid up front and waited several days. But that would have meant breaking Madagascar and international laws against smuggling an endangered animal.
How hard was it for you to not take that tortoise and save its life? If you leave it behind, who knows where it's going to end up?
It's incredibly frustrating. This animal is from such a tiny geography. You think you could wall it in and protect it.
There is one place in Madagascar that is trying to wall them in and protect them behind locks and razor wire. This national park deep in a forest.
Are these automatic rifles?
They certainly are, yep.
Richard Lewis is with the British conservation group Durell, which runs this refuge and breeding center.
Be careful of the youngsters here.
They're all over the place.
Yeah, just be careful.
Oh, here's some.
Watch where you step and then come on over. These are all adult males.
Look at them. Do you know how old they are?
This could be 50 years old, 100 years old, 150, 200 years old.
I mean, this is the longest-lived animal on the planet.
Their longevity is one of the reasons they're so valuable. Asian collectors believe owning one confers long life on them. The black market trade is now so lucrative that crime syndicates are involved. The center was robbed in the late 1990s in what was called one of the heists of the century.
So people actually broke into this compound, the breeding center, with all the security, and stole
75 youngsters and two adults. They stole, at that moment in time, it was half of the youngsters we'd ever bred.
Since then, with the help of Eric Good, the population of plowshares here has rebounded.
This is the female enclosure.
These girls are responsible for producing 300 offspring, 300 animals that you're looking at in this entire enclosure.
Very few people have ever seen them actually produce offspring, even here. But as we were just about to leave, one of the females wandered off and, to everyone's surprise, began to dig a nest for laying eggs.
Richard, have you ever seen this before?
No.
You have never seen?
Me personally, no. It's the luck of the draw, as it were.
Being a tortoise, the work was very slow and very plodding.
Yeah, it's remarkable. You think those legs are just these stubby elephantine feet, but they're very good at cupping the soil, digging this incredible little hole.
Yeah, and she could be, what, 60, 70 years old?
Yeah, 100 years old.
It took her almost an hour, and then...
Oh, there's the egg.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
Is she going to do another one?
Yep. Oh, there it goes. There it goes.
Oof.
Number two. This is what you work for.
Yep.
And even more so when the little tortoise, when the hatchling comes out, you feel like you've broken a secret code.
Good wants to emulate this kind of success back in the United States with not just plowshares, but dozens of other species. He has his own breeding center in the mountains outside of Los Angeles that he began with 150 turtles and tortoises given to him for safekeeping by the Bronx Zoo.
They were trucked across the United States, and they were the first guests in my tortoise hotel.
Each species is pampered like a guest at one of Good's hotels, with fresh-cut flowers, salad greens, and a tortoise smoothie blended with organic milk.
Each species needs a different ecosystem. Like this tortoise, for example, is from Burma, and this is biologically extinct in the wild. And these guys need to be kept warm and very high humidity.
He now has 680 animals from 30 endangered species.
This is a turtle from India and Bangladesh, maybe a little bit into Pakistan.
And these turtles that elsewhere would be on the menu.
It's called the golden coin turtle, probably one of the top 25 most endangered turtles in the world.
And young Galapagos tortoises that'll grow to 400 pounds.
These were bred in Texas at a zoo, and they've been raised here.
Don't come for my toes.
But Eric Good says he doesn't want any of his guests to stay too long.
Ideally, we'd like to send these animals back to the wild.
Why would you send them back? There's no protection for them back in the wild.
It may be too soon to send a lot of them back.
And can you? I mean, let's be realistic.
I don't know yet, but I think it's important to show that we're not just bringing animals into captivity and keeping them there forever.
For now, he's fulfilling his dream by protecting 11 plowshares and trying to breed more. Last year, he hatched 250 other tortoises and turtles. Eric Good is like Noah, building a safe haven for, in some cases, the last of these animals on Earth.
Go to 60MinutesOvertime.com for some of the more strange and wonderful sights from our trip to Madagascar.
I'm Leslie Stahl. We'll be back next week with another edition of 60 Minutes.